This afternoon, I'd like to continue essentially where we left off last time in our series on transforming ourselves through understanding temperaments. We looked at the lives of two Bible figures, Peter and Paul, during the last installment of this series. And this afternoon, we're going to go to the Old Testament and explore two other personalities and temperaments. But before I reveal their identity, let's just do a little bit of review regarding the concept of temperaments. If you'll recall, as we described Peter and Paul, they were quite different in their personalities and their approaches, and yet God used each of them for a very special task, and particularly in the case of Paul, God transformed him to the point of even changing his name, in a sense. Of course, Paul and Saul were both one and the same people. His transformation was quite dramatic. He was struck blind on the road to Damascus, and his life was never the same after that. And, of course, in Peter's case, Peter was quite the outspoken individual. If it was in his mind, it was out of his mouth before he could even think about it. And unfortunately, sometimes it caught him, as we relayed. But of course, in both cases, there were quite dramatic transformations in their perspectives and outlooks and in their personality traits, their temperaments, if you will. Once God's Spirit gets a hold of you, if you will, the transformation begins in earnest. And no matter what our temperament, our persuasion, our personality, our outlook, however our human nature is packaged, God will work with us as a potter works with clay. He will form us and shape us, and through the process of repentance or change, He will mold and shape us into one of His sons. And what a wonderful opportunity all of us have to become the sons of God and to have a loving Father who is willing to take that kind of time to develop each of us as His children. Now, in brief review, we have discussed the four basic human personalities that were first identified by the ancient Greeks and Romans. Understanding ourselves and others can benefit us in several ways, especially in regard to recognizing some of our inherent strengths and weaknesses, which can lead us to a deeper understanding of ourselves and a greater grasp of the things that we need to change in order to become more like our Heavenly Father. In a sense, understanding our temperament can help us identify how our human nature is packaged and what steps we can take to promote the transformation process. You know, it can also be a great tool in helping us understand one another and relate to one another so that we as members of the body of Jesus Christ can fit together just as the Apostle Paul described us in 1 Corinthians 12 as a body, as members of one body. All of our body members working together, supporting one another. It's a beautiful picture. We're a walking, talking, moving advertisement for the united body of Jesus Christ, the one body. And it is something for us to consider in the context of this discussion or this series on temperaments. It's also a good opportunity for us to recognize that often we are attracted to our own personality types. Now, sometimes opposites attract, like a magnet. What do two north poles? If you have two magnets, take both of the north poles and bring them together. What happens? Well, you can feel the resistance. But if you bring a south pole close to a north pole, what happens? Boom! They come together. Well, oftentimes opposites attract and the law of gravity is in place. But sometimes we are attracted to similar or identical personalities to our own. And in that case, often, we can't understand what is wrong
with the other person because they are different than we are. They don't like to be on time, apparently. We like to be on time. We like to be early. If we're not early, we feel we're late because being on time is really late. You need to be there early. Well, some people are more flexible. Others are more determined to be on time and precise. The inflexible people look at the flexible people and say, why can't you get your act together? And the inflexible people don't understand what they're talking about when they tell them, you know, you shouldn't be so inflexible. What is inflexible? Because I want to be on time. Why is that inflexible? So you have these little things going on. And oftentimes we don't bring a lot of these things up to other individuals we don't necessarily match up with. But these things go on in our minds. And we look at other people and we say, well, they're not like me. And sometimes I wonder if anybody is like me. Sometimes I wonder if God and I are the only two people like me. And so you can tend to be a little bit isolated from the reality of the variety that God created across the spectrum in His creation. So appreciating one another, appreciating God's great creative ability and the difference in temperaments and attitudes and approaches that God created, it's a marvelous study. And by no means is it an attempt to justify illegal, immoral, or ungodly behavior, because that has to be addressed no matter what your temperament is. Sin is sin. So these are elements of the discussion that I hope we can all benefit from. Now, much of the descriptive information that I'm going to share with you today as we explore two Old Testament personalities and their natural temperaments and how God transformed them in their lifetimes to become His sons and more like Him and His Son, Jesus Christ, I wanted to mention that much of the information that I will relay to you will be taken from a book entitled Transformed Temperaments by Tim LaHaye. But I will admit to having done a lot of my own research, and I have some of my own ideas, so you'll hear both, but I do want to give credit to Mr. LaHaye, and if you would like to pick that book up, I think you would find it an interesting read. And before we get into the two Old Testament personalities, I'd like to briefly mention Peter and Paul in the context of the different types of temperament measurement tools that we've been discussing. For as I mentioned earlier, the Greeks and Romans identified four basic personality types, and they named them after bodily fluids, if you will. Sanguine for blood, phlegmatic for phlegm, etc., etc. So there are other methods of identifying the four basic personalities that use colors. How many of you have identified your color as far as your personality? Anybody have ever done that? That's orange, gold, blue. So yellow, just different kinds of colors that are used to describe the personalities. Others have used animals, beavers, otters, lions, golden retrievers. The Myers-Briggs inventory or temperament inventory has 16 different categories and identifies four of those as your basic personality type. It's a little more sophisticated, and we're going to prepare and develop a handout that will enable you to determine what kind of temperament you have. Finally, you'll be able to understand yourself after all these years, but maybe not. And, of course, you're constantly changing, and that's the thing. If you doubt it, look at your high school graduation picture and see if you can recognize yourself. We are constantly changing in many ways, and that's the whole idea of repentance. So these different categories were used to help us understand Peter and Paul. And we'll get that information to you. It will help you understand your temperament here before the final installment in this series, which will be given 2 weeks from today. Peter was probably a sanguine or an SP or an otter by the descriptors that are used in the mechanisms that I just described to illustrate the different temperaments. Paul was probably a choleric. He was probably an NT in the Myers-Briggs temperament inventory. And a lion, undoubtedly, when it comes to the animals. And Peter was probably a lot like the gospel writer Mark. We talked about that, remember? One story, four writers. And Paul was probably a lot like the gospel writer John. So the first Old Testament character or personality that we're going to explore is Abraham, or shall I say Abram, because, of course, he had his name changed too. In fact, his name was changed to something rather unusual, considering his circumstance, and we'll read about that in just a few moments. Now, Abraham was probably a phlegmatic, a golden retriever, or an NF, or similar to the gospel writer Luke. People like Abraham, with his personality and temperament, people like Abraham are, generally speaking, sympathetic with and supportive of others. They're very easy to get along with, almost gregarious, enjoy being around other people, have a calm, easygoing demeanor. They are not very intense or demanding. They tend to make good diplomats. They like to be peacemakers. They don't like arguments. They are natural peacemakers, in fact. They are usually cheerful. They are somewhat idealistic and trusting. Occasionally, they can display a dry sense of humor, which helps them work well with others, kind of break down the barriers, and a little humor, a little laughter, and suddenly people are more comfortable with you. So that is a factor in this particular temperament or personality type. They are very often efficient, conservative, practical, and dependable. They tend to be introverts. Not extroverts, but introverts. Since they often are not one of the more expressive temperaments, they're not the life of the party. They aren't always talking. They may tend to keep their strengths and their particular attitudes that help them achieve and accomplish things in life more or less under wraps. They don't talk about themselves a lot. And their strengths and weaknesses may not be readily apparent. Here are some of their potential weaknesses. They can lack motivation. They can be stubborn. They have a tendency to be indecisive and perhaps a little naive at times. They can't decide things easily. People with this temperament sometimes prefer to observe from the bleachers rather than be involved on the field. And that's okay. You have to have people in the bleachers and you have to have people on the field. They tend to be good peacemakers, as I mentioned. They're natural diplomats. They might find themselves in the following fields. They might be teachers, social workers, doctors, healthcare workers, writers, journalists. They possess leadership potential when externally motivated, since they are reluctant to put themselves forward. Their sometimes apparent lack of enthusiasm should not taint your appreciation of their capabilities and strengths, for they can be leaders if they are pushed into a situation, but they don't automatically rise to that occasion as Peter did. Here, I'll walk on water. Here, let me do this, etc., etc. So that's a difference in personalities. So now let's take a look at Abram, a man who became known as the father of the faithful, but did he start out that way? Did he start out that way? Well, we're going to find out that he really didn't start out as the father of the faithful. Now, that doesn't mean he started out with no faith. And by no means do I mean to imply that I'm being critical of Abraham for his lack of faith. I'm going to try to illustrate how there were certain circumstances in his life that were difficult for Abraham to exercise faith in the midst of. Let's put it that way. Just as you and I are faced with similar circumstances, we cannot always put our total faith and confidence in God. Now, at least I should say I can't. Maybe you're different, and if you are, please don't raise your hand. Come talk to me privately afterwards. I want to know your secret. Because oftentimes there are multiple factors that prevent us from trusting God, from putting our faith and confidence in Him, from believing what He says. Because the external evidence tells us something different. And we're going to see that we're no different from Abraham and vice versa as we go through his story today. So I'm not going to turn to a lot of scriptures. However, I'm going to refer to the scriptural account of Abram or Abraham. So you can follow along if you like. We're going to start in Genesis chapter 11. And here we read of Abram's extended family leaving the land of Ur, with their ultimate destination being the land of Canaan. However, they stopped in Haran en route to Canaan, and it was there that Abram's father, Terah, died. Now, also accompanying Abram on this trip, in addition to his father, was Abraham's nephew, Lot. He made the journey. So, understandably, God was going to take Abraham to the land of what? Canaan. That was his destination. I have a question for you, and this is speculation. I cannot verify this, but I do wonder about it. I wonder if the initial call for Abram, as he was called at that point, to leave his country and his family behind and go to the place that God would choose, the place that God wanted him to go, I wonder if the initial command to do that was given before he left the land of Ur. I want you to take a look at Genesis 12 with me for just a moment. I think that will make the point a little clearer if we turn to Genesis 12. Here's what the Lord said to Abram: get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house. So this was apparently when he was, it was during his stopover in Haran. But listen to the nature of God's command: get away from your father's house, leave your family behind, get out of your country to a land that I will show you. So when he first left the land of Ur and stopped in Haran, who did he have along with him? He had his father and his nephew, and his nephew's family members. So was this a situation where gregarious Abram, this was part of his personality, he valued relationships, he liked being around people, he would have found it hard to leave his family behind. Am I blaming him? I don't think so. But look at the situation. He brought along his father. He brought along his nephew and his nephew's family. When his father died, that seems to be the break point. Then he left for the land of Canaan. But he still had his nephew with him. And so God still says, you leave your family and your country behind. But Lot still traveled with him from the land of Haran into Canaan. And Lot was there in the land of Canaan with him. That apparently wasn't God's idea. But God worked with it. Do you think everything that you and I do, or every idea that we have, or every course of action we decide on in our lives is God ordained right from the start, and that this is what exactly what God wants us to do? No, God works with us. I can tell you from personal experience, I've made some poor decisions in my life. And God in His mercy is still working with me. He's still working with you. He's working with Abram here. I'm just bringing this up to indicate that, yes, the father of the faithful did have a few issues, especially in the early going. But when we get to the mountain of sacrifice, I think all of those issues are gone. They are evaporated. For someone to do what Abraham did on that mountain with his own son, after he went through all of this, amazing. And yet here in this particular portion of his life, he was still learning. He was still growing. But God had not forsaken him. Now a famine struck the land of Canaan. What did Abram do? He fled to Egypt. He fled to Egypt. Now, could God have sustained him in the land of Canaan? I have to think so. Is there any indication that God said, get out of the land of Canaan where I told you to go, and go to the land of Egypt where you can eat because I have no idea how to feed you here? Well, of course, that wasn't the case. Now, it's interesting to note when he went to Egypt, how did he tell Sarah, his wife, to introduce herself as his sister? Sarah was, in Texas parlance, a real looker, apparently. And Abraham knew what the situation would be like if he traveled into Egypt or perhaps other countries where rulers had harems or multiple wives, and an attractive woman was attractive, and they might be tempted to eliminate the attractive woman's husband if it meant getting the attractive woman for themselves. So Abraham talked with Sarah before they left and said, look, just for my safety's sake, basically, what other reason could there be? For my safety's sake, will you introduce yourself as my sister? It was true. She was his half-sister. I say it's true. Can we say it's half-true? And if something is half-true and half-false, which half usually wins, quote-unquote? The false part, because it usually comes around to bite you and to injure you, which it did to Abraham. Because, true to form, what did Pharaoh say? I like the looks of Sarah, and she is Abraham's sister, so it's open season. I'm going after Sarah. God said, don't you do that. She's another man's wife. Pharaoh was very upset. He had almost made a grave mistake that cost him dearly. What did he do with Abraham and Sarah and their entourage? Booted them out of the country and sent them running. So here was a case where I don't know if God can protect me. I've got a beautiful wife. Did he subject Sarah to some uncomfortable looks and stares from other people in order to maybe give him a little higher survival rate when he traveled? I don't know. You can think about it. You can look at it. But it would appear that this is the case. And it happened a second time, if you'll recall. And we'll refer to that here in just a couple of minutes. So that trip was not a good one. Now, they survived. Apparently, they got food. But they wound up back in Canaan. Now, regarding the promises made to Abram, they were of such magnitude and scope that it must have been difficult for him to fully comprehend what God had in store. I mean, try to imagine, at 75, you and your wife, childless, God says, I'm going to make of you a great nation. In fact, in you, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Your descendants will be as numerous as the sand on the seashore, as the stars in the heavens. And you're looking around at your old wife and your old self. And you're looking for children, and there are none. And you're looking at the stars in the heavens and the sand of the seashore. You're looking at zero on your side of the scoreboard, and you're looking at millions on the other side, and you're asking, how do we get from here to there? Well, only God can take you. And I can imagine myself being a doubter, can't you? And so you see, through 25 years, the promises were reinforced and redescribed and enhanced, and God gave more information, more reassurance, but when it came down to it, they were really not convinced until essentially Sarah actually gave birth. And that in itself is an amusing tale, and we're going to read that in just a few minutes. Now, as I mentioned, God changed Abram's name to Abraham. What does Abraham mean? Father of many nations. Well, what a laugher that must have been. You're still looking around. The score is still zero. And I want to change your name to Father of many nations. Well, here, how, when, where? 25 years they went. Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac arrived. Think about that long period of time. And even at 75, it was doubtful. Were the odds getting any better as the years went along? I don't think so. I don't think so. And yet, does God play the odds? No, He doesn't. It's a sure thing with God. Now, we can look at this story and we can say, well, yes, I would. If I were Abraham, I would have believed. I wouldn't have doubted. I wouldn't have questioned. Well, I know I would have, and I think most of us would admit to doing the same. So God, in His mercy, continued to work with Abraham, and truly, he did become the father of the faithful. A remarkable story. Now, upon their return from Egypt, Abraham and Lot just bumped into each other. Their flocks, their herds, their servants, it was just too much for them to live together. So, remember we talked about the nature of Abraham's temperament being peacemaker? So, he wanted to have peace with Lot. So, what did he do? He looked out over the land and he said, look, I'm the senior man here. You're my nephew. I'm your uncle. And I'm going to take the land that I think is best for me, and you can go wherever you want to. Is that what he said? No. He really made a magnanimous and generous gesture. He said to Lot, you look out over the land. You take what you want to take, and I'll take what's left. So what did Lot do? He looked out over the watered valley and plain that of the Jordan that actually included two prominent cities, Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, what was their reputation at that time? I don't know. But nonetheless, Lot chose the fertile valley, and Abraham let him have it, and he went his own way. Now, just to illustrate some of this, I want you to turn to Genesis 13, and this gives a little bit more of an idea of why I think that this could be the first point that Abraham really left his family and everything behind at this point, when he separated himself from Lot. Because notice, right after that happened, again, verse 12, Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan. Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, pitched his tent as far as Sodom. And the men were wicked and evil in Sodom, as we know. Now, verse 14, the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward. All the land which you see, I will give to you and your descendants forever. So he reinforced the promise, expanded it as far as you can see, north, south, east, west. I don't care what you gave up for Lot. That's nothing. Everything you see, I will give to you for an inheritance. And essentially, this is the first time that Abraham fulfilled God's command. Leave your family. And it would seem that God honored that separation by expanding the promise and reassuring Abraham, which is something he did time and time again throughout the account. Now, reassurance is something we all need, because all of us have been asked to leave something behind, be it family, be it friends, be it a job. Think about your life and your calling. God asks us all to leave it all behind, because ultimately, you and I will leave everything physical behind. Everything. So, what a marvelous lesson is illustrated here in the life of Abraham, and we can see the same thing in our lives. We need to leave it all behind. And what does your human nature want to do? Well, it wants to hang on to as much of it as we can. What did Abraham want to do? Well, he brought his father along. He brought his nephew along. His father died in Haran. His nephew was sort of a ball and chain, because we haven't heard the last of Lot yet, have we? But when he did leave it all behind, then God reinforced and expanded the blessing. And all of us can benefit from that knowledge as well. Now, remember we said that Abraham's temperament was not a born leader, but if external circumstances forced it upon him, he would take the lead. Well, Lot and his family were captured by marauders and taken away. When Abraham heard it, he gathered together his servants, an army, if you will, and he rescued Lot and his family. And, of course, that was the incident where he came back and met with Melchizedek and offered up tithes. Remember the account? So this was an act of leadership on Abraham's part. And if you'll recall, when God was threatening to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham negotiated with God. Remember that? Well, now, God, would you destroy the righteous with the wicked? Does that make sense? God said, well, no, I guess I wouldn't. Well, if there were 50 righteous, would you destroy the city? Well, no, not for 50, I wouldn't. Well, what about 40? He went down 50, 40, 30, 20. He got down to 10. And God said, for the sake of 10 righteous, I won't destroy the city. But as we know, when the messengers went into Sodom and Gomorrah and saw the evil and experienced the evil and attempted to extract Lot's family, it was a disaster. And the cities were destroyed. Lot and his wife barely escaped. In fact, his wife did not make it, did she? He and his daughters did. So, interesting asides here. Now let's move to Genesis chapter 16. Well, now you can imagine, as the years go along, these promises are out there. You're going to have children, and your descendants are going to be so numerous, you won't be able to count them. So, how long can you, as a woman, hear that and still be barren and not feel a sense of guilt, some pressure? How about Abraham? Well, he was probably feeling the pressure. Where is this son going to come from? We keep trying. We're getting older, 75, 80, 85, 90. It's just not happening. So what does creative, ingenious human nature like to do? Second guess God and come up with an alternative plan. This should work, said Sarah. Here is my handmaiden, Hagar. Now, why don't you go in and have relations with her? Perhaps she could bear the son of promise, and then we could get underway with all of this, and some of the stress would be taken off of me. Now, I wasn't there. I don't know what Sarah said, but I could imagine her feeling that way. And I wonder if Abraham perhaps felt the pressure again of possible confrontation and continued frustration between Sarah and himself. And basically, the peacemaker in him said, well, that might not be such a bad idea. That might calm Sarah down. If we had a son, then that would be the key to opening up these blessings, and maybe this pressure to have a baby would make my relationship with my wife better. And so in he goes. And sure enough, Hagar has a baby. It's a boy. And is this going to be the son of promise? No, God says it's not going to work. Taking that detour is not going to get you to the destination that I want. Sarah will have a son. And Abraham will father that son with Sarah. That was God's plan from the beginning. Their attempt to take a detour was not effective. And it caused a great deal of family trauma, didn't it? Because what happened? Sarah and Hagar could not get along, and finally, Abraham had to expel Hagar and her child. But God, in his mercy, took them under his wing and blessed them and gave them a future, you might say, of their own. But that did not change the promise or the outcome that he had already offered to Abraham. So this attempt at a detour did not work out very well. Now, in Genesis 20, Abraham identifies Sarah as his sister a second time. Now, this is the account of their visit to Abimelech, king of Gerar. Now, the fruit of the deception was not good this time either, because Abimelech was highly offended. And although he gave gifts and presents to Abraham and Sarah, it was more of an effort to make up for his own indiscretion. And he didn't want this to bear evil on his own reputation and put a smirch or a mark on his name. So he was not satisfied with Abraham doing this either. So this did not work out well on either occasion to ask Sarah to identify herself as his sister. So up until the time of the birth of Isaac, which found Abraham at age 100, Abraham and Sarah were both doubtful skeptics regarding those promises. His birth was clearly a turning point in their lives and in their relationship with God. Let's turn to Genesis 21 and just read a little bit about the birth. And of course, we all know that Sarah, at one point, was laughing at the very prospect of that promise. And when the angelic messengers accused her of laughing, what did she say? Oh, no, I didn't laugh. And what did the messenger say? Ah, but you did laugh. And she did laugh. And truly, it was laughable that two people, their age and station in life, would have a child themselves. Can you blame her for laughing? Let's see how she turns that laughing incident around. It's rather amusing here in Genesis 21. And the Lord visited Sarah. I want you to notice the wording here. Notice the wording. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said. You'll read constantly here in these early verses of the chapter, God inspired Moses, the author of these five books, to write these words that reinforce God's intention from the beginning. Just as he said, so things happened. The Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. Exactly. Without the help of Hagar. Verse 2. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age. When did that happen? At the set time of which God had spoken to him. Check out that emphasis. Verse 3. And Abraham called the name of his son who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him. In case there's any doubt, these three verses keep hammering the point. She called him Isaac. Now, look in the margin and tell me what the name Isaac means. Who knows? Who can tell? Anybody have a margin? Laughter. Laughter. Now, really, it's to me almost a signal that Sarah recognized her foolishness and her lack of faith and basically named her son to remind herself and future generations not to snicker at the promises of God. And by the same token, it's a name that will remind her of the consummate joy that she and her husband experienced, the laughter of joy and happiness as their son was born, their only son. What a marvelous story. Let's continue. Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Now, Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Now, verse 6, quite insightful here about Sarah. Sarah said, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. Everyone who reads this story, and if you will, sees how doubtful I was in the early going and how joyous I am now, will laugh with me when they read that I named my only son Laughter. She also said, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? For I have borne him a son in his old age. Indeed, who would have said that? No one else but God would have said it, and no one else but God could have done it. It's quite a story, isn't it? Now, Genesis 22, we all know this account. What an incredible test. Think of all that Abraham and Sarah went through. And many have speculated at this point that Isaac may have been about 30, about the same age as Jesus Christ when he was sacrificed. If that's the case, how old was Abraham? 130. Speculation, but nonetheless, just think about it. How long would it have taken Abraham and Sarah to bond with little Isaac? Maybe 10 nanoseconds. Huh? Wouldn't have taken 30 years, would it? Can you imagine how close the parents and the son were? That son of promise, for whom they had waited 25 years. After 30 more years, let's say, 55 years. 25 waiting, 30 enjoying and rejoicing. And now God asks you to sacrifice your son. Wow. What would that take out of you and out of your wife to hear that news? What would you do? How would you respond? Notice verse 3 of Genesis 22. Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took his servants, grabbed some wood, took Isaac, and left, following God's instruction the very next day. Does that sound like the same Abraham that left the land of Ur with his father and his nephew and stopped off in Haran? Doesn't sound like the same man, does it? What a remarkable expression of faith. This story almost brings you to tears. 3 days they traveled. On the third day, Abraham saw the place, verse 4, where the sacrifice was to take place. Verse 5, Abraham said to the young man, for the young men that he brought with him, his servants, stay here with me, or with the donkey, rather. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you. We will come back to you. We, plural. And later on, verse 7, Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, "My father." And Abraham said, "Here I am, my son." Then Isaac said, "Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" Can you imagine how that would have choked Abraham up? Abraham's response is astounding in its expression of faith. Abraham said, verse 8, "My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering." So the two of them went together. You know, I'd like you to turn to Hebrews 11. Because here we're going to read a little bit more about this account. And it will shed some additional light on the situation. Hebrews 11. Verse 17, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, as all of us are, offered up Isaac." Yes, he did offer him up. He bound him. He put him on the altar. He raised the knife. He did everything but plunge the knife and take his life. He did offer up his son, even as the Father offered up his son, Jesus Christ. "And he who had received the promises, Abraham, offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, 'In Isaac your seed shall be called.'" All this time, and now at 130, what was Abraham to believe, that God would give him another son through Sarah at this advanced age? Well, let's read on. Verse 19, "concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense." The implication here is that Abraham's faith was so strong, his belief in the promise of God, that he was willing to take Isaac's life based on God's command in faith, knowing that God could raise him up, could resurrect him, and bring him back down the mountain with him. And he did receive Isaac in a figurative sense as he rose up off of the altar, because he was as good as dead when Abraham raised that knife, wasn't he? "By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob," etc., etc., as the faith chapter goes on. Quite an amazing story of an enduring and endearing testimony of faith, as both father and son submitted to the will of God. Because at age 30, if he was that old, do you think he could have resisted his aging father's attempts to bind him and put him on that altar? So were they both submitting to the will of God in that case on that mountain? What a marvelous and beautiful example of faith. No wonder Abraham is called the father of the faithful. I'd just like to be the son of the father of the faithful. He is the father of the faithful and set an outstanding example of faith. Now let's move to Moses. Moses. Moses was probably a melancholic, an SJ, a beaver, or similar to the gospel writer Matthew, as we have discussed previously. Now here are some common characteristics of Moses' temperament. They are often viewed as traditional, conservative, well-organized, detail-oriented, and responsible. Huh. If you're going to take 2 to 5 million Israelites on a 40-year campout with little or nothing, you need to be organized, if nothing else. You need to be very detail-oriented. These kinds of personalities bring structure and stability to societies and cultures. They are also very sensitive to failure, either real or perceived. They tend to be analytical and self-sacrificing. They can be loyal, faithful friends. They may be considered as reserved or inflexible or even judgmental. Not bending, very rigid. You have to do it this way. They are not necessarily demonstrative. Their weaknesses can include being moody, critical, pessimistic, self-deprecating, and sometimes they can get fed up with people. Now, you notice I said fed up with people. Sometimes they sort of move above the realm of people, and they get fed up with all the rest of us down here because they're up here. And they can tend to take the role of a martyr. Well, woe is me. Why do I have to do all of this? Why is this my job? Why don't people listen to me? Etc., etc. They often make good administrators and analysts, physicians, bankers, teachers, religious educators, guidance counselors, even accountants. Now, Moses' life can be divided into three 40-year periods. The number 40 is the number of what? Trial. And think about dividing your life into three equal periods of 40 and having unique challenges and trials in each of the three categories. That's exactly what Moses confronted in his life. It really is an exciting story. I can see why Hollywood was attracted to it all those years ago. And it's even more exciting when you read the biblical account and understand it. Moses spent the first 40 years growing up in Pharaoh's court. His name means drawn out. And of course, that he was reminded of his birth every time he thought about his name. Because as you know, Pharaoh had placed an edict in place, a command in place. All the male Israelite babies were to be killed. The females could be kept, but the boys had to be killed. Pharaoh was worried that the Egyptians would be overpowered by the large number of Israelites that seemed to be growing constantly. So his idea was to kill the males and keep the females. Well, the Israelites, of course, were not compliant with that in every way. Moses' mother wasn't. She put little baby Moses in a basket, sent him down the Nile River. Pharaoh's daughter picks the basket up out of the river. And long story short, Moses winds up growing up as Pharaoh's son, if you will, or grandson. In Pharaoh's court, Egypt being one of the most powerful and prominent nations of the age and time, he probably received an excellent education. He was probably a skilled writer, a high intellect. As I mentioned, he was used by God to write the first five books of the Bible, the books of Moses, if you will. He cataloged the history. So his first 40 years were spent maturing in Pharaoh's court. And how much of that time was spent thinking about his origins, thinking about the difference in class, you might say, between him as Pharaoh's grandson, if you will, and his fellow Israelites as slaves, building buildings and working for Pharaoh, and who knows, perhaps working for Moses, even as the movie depicted. Now, he spent the next 40 years tending flocks and herds, right? And the last 40 years of his life, he tended Israelites and shepherded them. And after 120 years, he was not able to enter the Promised Land. That must have been a great disappointment to Moses, and yet we'll talk about that in just a moment. Let's read in Acts 7, verse 22, because Stephen has a little something to add to the first 40-year period of Moses' life. Acts 7, 22. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was mighty in words and deeds. Now, I want you to notice here in verse 23, now when he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was being oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. He killed an Egyptian who was abusing one of the Israelite slaves, or the Hebrew slaves. Verse 25 is very enlightening. According to Stephen, he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, and they did not understand. So, for the first 40 years of Moses' life, he must have had an understanding of his calling, of his origin, of his destiny. He knew that he was drawn out of the river for a reason, and at this particular point, at age 40, he decided that it was time to release his Israelite brothers and sisters from bondage. And he took it upon himself to slay an Egyptian who was abusing one of the Hebrew or Israelite slaves. And of course, the next day, he found two of the Israelites fighting. And he broke that fight up. And one of them said, "What are you going to do to me now? Kill me as you killed that Egyptian?" Of course, Moses then knew that the jig was up, and he fled the country for fear of being arrested for murdering an Egyptian. So here is Moses moving forward with a plan that was in place in his own mind. He knew what God probably intended for him. There was some sense of his destiny, but he moved about 40 years too soon. And it didn't work. And it was a failure. And he was running away from his whole life, out into the wilderness. It must have been a very discouraging time for someone who likes order, who likes the plan, who likes lists, and who wants to get things done and accomplish things, who feels very sensitive about failing and always wants to succeed. Remember, as Stephen said here about Moses, he was mighty in words and mighty in deeds. He was an achiever. And now he was ready to sacrifice himself, to risk his life in Pharaoh's court, and to pull together his fellow Israelites and relieve them from the slavery and the abuse that they were experiencing. And they rejected him. And he was out in the wilderness wandering. Quite an experience. And it must have been very discouraging to him and his considering his personality. Now let's turn to Hebrews 11 again and get a little more background before we actually go into the Old Testament account. Hebrews 11. Verse 23. By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. So they didn't kill the baby, they preserved little baby Moses. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. He esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he looked to the reward. You see, it's indicating here that ultimately he made that choice and that decision. Ultimately he made the choice and decision to forsake Egypt and leave it all behind. But in the case of his first departure, he ran in fear. And if he should have chosen to come back, he could have chosen to try to work his way back into Pharaoh's court instead of risking his life to save the Israelites. He didn't do that. Now, it took God some cajoling and some work to get him, after 40 years of sheep herding, to return to Egypt. But ultimately, by faith, he forsook Egypt. He didn't fear the wrath of the king. He endured as seeing him who is invisible. He kept the Passover. He led them through the Red Sea and all the rest of the outstanding events in the life of Moses. That, too, an expression of faith. And he finally completely forsook Egypt and rose to the occasion. But it appears that he tried the first time 40 years too soon and found himself out in the wilderness. He eventually ran into Jethro, the priest of Midian. Jethro gave him his daughter, Zipporah, as a wife. He and Zipporah had children, and he became a shepherd working for his father-in-law. 40 years of that lifestyle. 40 years. I'm sure he remembered the failure as the slap in the face when he tried to save his fellow Israelites, but they refused him. I'm sure it was as fresh 40 years later as it was the day it happened. Because his temperament could not accept failure. It was embarrassing. It was humiliating. So after 40 years of herding sheep, he saw a burning bush. Now, he'd been outside the Egyptian ruling class, away from the suffering of his Israelitish brethren. He might have forgotten them, but God did not. And when God remembered them, God moved to bring the deliverer on board. The man who seemed ready to go 40 years ago was now reluctant, even dismissive. In fact, he didn't want to go. And we'll see that here in just a moment. Yes, the burning bush. We've read about it many times. We'll see that every attempt that God made to overcome and overrule Moses' doubts and fears and shortcomings failed to have the desired effect. Moses and his temperament style was so burdened by his previous failure that he found it hard to believe God and accept his calling and his charge. Perhaps he was fearful of failing again and decided he's not going to try it a second time, even though God reassured him. And remember, the tendency of this temperament is to be moody, critical, pessimistic, self-centered, and at times they like to play the martyr. Well, I tried this once before. You didn't want me then. Why do you want me now? Etc. So let's look at the objections that Moses raised at the burning bush. The first was this. Who am I? Who am I? Well, Moses knew who he was. We already read about that even in Hebrews. He knew somewhat of his destiny, and he tried to lay hold on it 40 years earlier. But now he's saying, who am I? I don't have any talent. I can't do this. I'm just a common sheep herder. And how much of that was his personality trying to push away God and this offer because he really didn't want it? Well, we'll examine some more here in just a moment. Of course, the question is, can God make up for your deficiencies? Of course he can. If he wanted you to be Moses, he could make you Moses. In multiple ways, and without saying so directly, it appeared that Moses simply didn't want the job, and we'll see that was the case. God's Spirit will carry us where our own talent, our own might, our own power and strength could never go, especially if our ego is in the way. That has to be taken off to the side, too. Okay, Moses' second objection. Well, What am I going to tell the children of Israel when they ask me who sent you to us? I remember the last time I tried to go to them. I saved one of my fellow Israelites from being beaten to death, and that's the kind of gratitude I got. They didn't want any part of me. I had to run for my life. So if I go and tell Pharaoh, tell the children of Israel, rather, that I've been sent to them by a burning bush, what are they going to say? You're a nut. You're crazy. We don't believe you. Again, did he remember that rebuke from his fellow Israelite so many years ago? I think he did. See, at that point, he was ready to go, but now he's not. God explained exactly what he expected Moses to deliver to the Israelites, a message of deliverance, hope, and victory over their captors by the hand of who I am. That's who you say sent you. I am sent you. And God also explained to Moses that the hardness of Pharaoh's heart would prevent him from letting them go, and he would only let them go by a mighty hand. So you can just see the wheels turning in Moses' head. Well, he wouldn't support me the first time, and now he appears to want me, God that is, to go in there the second time, but he's saying that he is going by a mighty hand to bring them out, but Pharaoh is going to refuse to let them go. So it sounds to me like the potential for failure is still there. I don't really want to do this. I don't think there's any guarantee that it's going to work. The third objection. What if they won't believe me when I tell them that you sent me? So first he said, who shall I tell them sent me? I am. Well, now I say, I am sent me. What if they don't believe that? Well, then, God showed him three things that he could do. He said, pick up your staff, your shepherd's crook. Throw it down. What happened? Became a serpent. Now, I could do that, but the second part, I don't know. Pick it up now. So he picked up the serpent, became a staff again. Stick your arm inside your coat. Pull it out. Leprous. Stick your arm inside your coat. Pull it out. Healed. Pour this water out. Blood. It's not water any longer, it's blood. Three signs that he could use. Supernatural signs to prove that God had sent him. Did that convince Moses? No. What was his fourth objection? I can't speak. Remember what we read about in Hebrews 11? Powerful in word and powerful in deed. Did he somehow lose that as a sheep herder? I don't know. Is this self-deprecation again? Is this the martyr complex coming in? Could be. I'm not eloquent. What did God say? His first response, kind of humorous. Who made man's mouth? Yeah, who made your mouth, Moses? I can make your mouth work better. I could lubricate the jaw, I can make your tongue. I can make this work, Moses. You don't have to worry about that. I can fix that problem. You go, I will be with your mouth, and I will teach you what to say. Was that good enough? No. Finally, what's his fifth plea? Please send someone else. Please send someone else. That was it. So, after four retorts, we finally get down to the truth, probably. I don't want to go. That's the bottom line. Finally, the real reason surfaces. Moses didn't want to go. God's anger was finally kindled. It took five attempts for Moses to light God's fire, but he finally did it. And he promised to appoint Moses' brother Aaron as his spokesman, and at that point, as we read in Exodus 4, verse 18, so Moses went. Finally, Moses went. And we can say, well, I would have gone right away. I wouldn't have given any of those objections. Well, I doubt it. What are the odds? I mean, really, the two of you going back into Egypt, the most powerful nation on earth at the time, in all likelihood, and you're going to lead several million Israelites out over the objections of Pharaoh and his mighty armies? Sound like fun? Sound like a high percentage of success? Well, you've got to hand it to Moses. He did it. Now, of course, we're going to go through several highlights in the life of Moses here as we continue. But let's notice again, speaking of a typical trait of this temperament. It is not unusual for people of this type to become depressed from time to time and experience severe mood swings. Now, who can fault Moses for getting upset with the children of Israel? I can't. I had three sons, not 3 million. And I got upset at times. 3 million. I've characterized it this way. Think of 3 million baby robins in a huge nest, all of them with their beaks wide open and making a cacophonous sound that you can't believe, and only one mother with the charge of getting the worm and feeding all of those mouths. That's the way it must have felt. We don't have any water. I'm tired of manna. Why can't we have meat? You brought us out here to kill us. On and on it went. For 40 years. 40 years. Of course you'd get frustrated. So let's look at one example here. Numbers 11. Numbers 11. I'm not blaming Moses. I would have done worse. I would have blown up before this, I'm sure. But Moses kind of blows a gasket here. And this is a little bit of a mood swing, if you will. The people were complaining again. Surprise, surprise. They wanted meat. And let's begin here in verse 10. Then Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, every one at the door of his tent. And the anger of the Lord was greatly aroused. So everybody was just crying, standing outside of their tent. This was well into their journey. They were tired of manna. They were just complainers. That's what they were. God was displeased. Moses was displeased. It says God was greatly aroused. Verse 11, Moses speaks up. He says to the Lord, and this is Mr. Martyr coming out again. Listen to this. Why have you afflicted your servant? Moi, Moses. Why have you done this to me? Now, when you think back, think of the confidence God placed in Moses to make him the deliverer of 3, 4, 5 million people, to fulfill the promise to Abraham. It was an honor, just as our calling is an honor. But sometimes we feel like saying the same thing to God. Why are you doing this to me? And that's just the way human nature is at times, but this temperament is particularly prone to it. Why have I not found favor in your sight? You, Moses, you were saved out of the water. You grew up in Pharaoh's court. I preserved you for 80 years. I have supernaturally brought you to this point, and you're saying, why have I not found favor in your sight? That you have laid the burden of all these people on me. It's all on me, God. It sounds like the Elijah complex. I am the only one. All of these other people are pagans. I'm the only one. No, he wasn't the only one. And of course, here in spades, he wasn't the only one. What do you think God was carrying around? He was carrying around the Israelites and Moses. Did I, verse 12, conceive all these people? Did I beget them, that you should say to me, carry them in your bosom, as a guardian carries a nursing child to the land which you swore to their fathers? This is all your deal, God. You made the promise. These are your children. Basically, I want out. This is too much. Why have you laid this on me? Where am I to get meat to give all of these people? Can you tell me that? The same place you got manna. The same place you got water. From the great Almighty God. But Moses is exacerbated. He's taking it all personally. He is now the martyr. He is angry. He is upset. And he's blaming God. There's no safe way here. Even if there were, how would I get enough food for them? For they weep all over me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. Give us meat that we may eat. Probably they had a chant going. Oh, it must have been terrible. After so many times, you get weary. Right? Verse 14, I am not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me. Now, in some ways, this personality likes to work alone because other people often don't stack up to their quality standards. And they like to do most everything themselves because it's easier to do it yourself than to do it over after someone else tries to do it in an inferior way. Now, God in His mercy appoints 70 elders to assist Moses. And if you recall, there's one other incident where his father-in-law comes into the camp and sees Moses sitting before the people day and night, judging every problem and every issue. What did Jethro say? You know, that's not a good idea, Moses. Why don't you appoint captains of 10, captains of 100, captains of 1,000? Then you hear only the very difficult cases, and your captains can take the load off. And Moses did it, and it worked. The 70 elders helped relieve the pressure. But here's the ultimate martyr comment. If you treat me like this, please kill me here and now. If I have found favor in your sight, and do not let me see my wretchedness. Oh, please kill me now. I don't think he really meant that. He was just completely exacerbated and frustrated. And God did not kill him. God gave him help. God in His mercy will give us help, even if we get exasperated and angry and blame Him. Now, in Moses' defense, do you recall the time God got so angry that He told Moses, stand aside. I will destroy them all, and I will start over with you. Now, if you and I were Moses, we'd probably say, you know, that's a good idea. I like me. And my descendants wouldn't be nearly as much trouble as these people. So yeah, go ahead. Moses didn't say that. Moses said to God, what will the Egyptians say? What will the world say? You make all these promises and then you kill the people you made the promises to? That's not going to work. That's bad press. And God relented. Now, how all that works into God's omniscience, what all was going on there in the conversation between God and Moses, I'm not about to speculate on. I'm just saying that Moses went to the defense of the Israelites in that case, but at this point, he had had it up to his proverbial keister, wherever that is, and he couldn't take it anymore. And he lost it. But God, in His mercy, allowed Moses to find it again. And, of course, there's also the situation where he went up to the mount with the directive to bring down the commandments of God. He went up there to commune with God. And, of course, when he came down the mountain and saw the hedonistic celebration going on, saw the golden calf, that his brother Aaron said, look, here's how it happened, Moses. I just threw all this gold in the fire, and out came this calf. I just don't know how that happened. Well, they ground the calf up into powder, put it in the water. Everybody had to drink it. People died. People were screaming. It was mayhem. But as Moses came down the mountain, slam, he threw those tablets against the rocks. They shattered. Now, he got angry, and with some justification. But you can see the up-and-down nature of Moses. He was criticized for a marriage that he undertook. He was always under the gun. There was always something going on that caused him to have difficulty. But, you know, by and large, to do what Moses did took a great deal of courage and conviction, a great deal of organization and determination, a lot of confidence, a lot of hard work. Not an easy task. Now, many other instances sparked an angry response. But the most telling of these is found in Numbers 20. Numbers 20. Now, Moses' sister Miriam had just died. It must have been an emotional time for him. You know, the three of them worked together, Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, brothers and sister. In this case, in Numbers 20, the Israelites were upset because there was no water. This wasn't the first time. Moses and Aaron both went to the tabernacle, fell on their faces before God, and they asked him to intervene. God instructed Moses to speak to the rock, but in this case, Moses' anger was directed to the children of Israel, and he drew attention to himself rather than God. Notice in Numbers 20, verse 10. Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels." Of course, I would have called them worse. I would have been right in there with him. You know, you have it up to here. They are complaining again. But you see, Moses takes too much upon him. He draws attention to himself instead of humbly directing the people to look to God for their sustenance and for the miracle. "Hear now, you rebels, must we, Aaron, my brother, and myself, bring water for you out of this rock?" Now, this may not sound like a big deal to you and to me. And it may not have sounded like a big deal to Aaron and Moses. But it was a big deal to God, because Moses disobeyed. He did not follow through. And you can imagine, when Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock, he must have been absolutely dumbfounded when nothing happened. For he had to strike the rock twice. The first time didn't work. And I wonder if he knew the jig was up at that point. I wonder if he recognized his error at that point. He struck the rock a second time. The little robins in the nest got their water again. But the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, verse 12, "Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." And Aaron died, and Moses died before the children of Israel entered. Now, I'd like to close this portion by turning to Deuteronomy 34. Deuteronomy 34. Undoubtedly, the most remarkable and unusual funeral ever performed. This is quite a moving account. "Then Moses went up from the plains," verse 1, Deuteronomy 34. Verse 1, "Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan. All of Naphtali describes the land. They could see a long distance. They could see the promised land from the top of Mount Nebo. And it's described here. In fact, in the words of Moses, as God inspired them. Then, verse 4, the Lord said to him, "This is the land of which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there." So Moses, the servant of the Lord, and remember, in the rebellion, when there were those who accused Moses of taking too much on himself, Korah and his cohorts, we're all the same. We all had the same connection with God. God essentially said, "How dare you? I speak face to face with Moses." You know, Moses, if you will, was a friend of God. Moses was so close to God that God performed his funeral. That's how close they were. When you go through something like that together, even if you're God and man, you get close. "I have caused you to see it with your eyes, but you shall not cross over there." So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he, capital H, buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, opposite Beth Peor, but no one knows his grave to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, nor his natural vigor diminished. He could have easily entered the promised land. But because of his disobedience, God prevented that. Verse 8, "And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses ended." And I would imagine that after all they had been through those 40 years with Moses, to know that he was dead must have been a very disconcerting, emotional, and moving event for the entirety of the nation. They wept for 30 days. They mourned his death for 30 days. And as one final comment on the tribute that God paid to Moses, not only did he bury him, but I would ask you, who appeared with Elijah in the vision of the kingdom shown to Peter, James, and John by Christ himself? Who appeared? Moses. Moses and Elijah, in figure, in a vision, depicting the kingdom of God. They'll both be there, of course. And Moses' temperament was, and he had his issues, and he had his concerns. And he was a stickler for detail. And he was a perfectionist. But God worked with him. God filed down those rough edges, refined him, and honored him, and will embrace him in the kingdom. So as we conclude this afternoon, we have looked at two more biblical characters and their temperaments. We've examined them, and we found some similarities between them and us. So between now and the final installment of this series, we're going to offer each of you an opportunity to discover your temperament along with its distinctive strengths and weaknesses. And in the final sermon on this series, we will discuss practical ways in which we can put the information we've heard to work in our lives, in our congregations, and in the church of God. So we'll discuss those strategies for applying what we've learned in the next and the final installment of this series on temperaments, refining them and becoming the sons of God.